Cyberbullying has gotten a lot of attention in the last few years, including the attention of online activist groups like Anonymous.
These groups work to punish those implicated in bullying or sexual assault cases, sometimes encouraging police to reopen cases that they had closed.
But there can be a complex side to this kind of activism, one that has critics calling activists bullies, just like the bullies they're trying to punish.
Our guest took a deeper look into the online activist world. She's here to talk about what she found.
Emily Basildon joins us now. She's author of Sticks and Stones, Defeating the Culture of Bullying and Rediscovering the Power of Character and Empathy. She's also a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine and a senior editor at Slate. Emily, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, I want to start by getting our terminology straight. There's bullying, there's cyberbullying, and I wonder if you could sort of start by defining some of the terms here. And let's start with the activism that's going on online. Can you tell us about that and what it is?
Well, there are people who see stories, especially stories of sexual assault, that they think the authorities haven't addressed. And they kind of bubble up online sometimes because of news coverage and also because increasingly kids are taking pictures of things that happen at parties or social gatherings, and sometimes those pictures are used to humiliate girls. So when things like that start circulating on social media, there are people who are very sensitive to that and kind of are on the lookout and have their antennae up. And then if they feel like there's a real injustice here, they may take it upon themselves to do something about it.
And would you call those people cyber activists?
I usually think of them as internet activists. And some of them, as you mentioned earlier, are part of Anonymous, which is this very loosely defined collection of activists and hackers that's been around for the last 6 or 7 years.
Now, there have been a few key high-profile cases involving rapes that have come to our attention because of the sensational nature and often a sense that people have that justice hasn't been served. And these have been the sorts of cases that these cyber activists or internet activists have gravitated to. And there's one that you talk about in Nova Scotia, which is a good case point. I wonder if you could walk us quickly through that case.
Yeah, sure. So this case involves a girl named Rutaya Parsons. And when she was 15, she went over to a boy's house with a friend, and there was a lot of drinking and some sexual activity. And Rutaya woke up in the morning. She wasn't entirely sure what happened, but she thought she had been raped by 4 boys. And there was a picture of one of the boys having sex with her that what circulated around her school, and she was called all kinds of names. And it was a really, really difficult time for her. She switched schools, but about a year afterward, she very sadly committed suicide. And one of the things that happened before she died was that the police decided not to prosecute any of the boys, either for the sexual assault or for the photo. So when the story of her suicide broke, her parents wrote posts online in which they were very angry with the criminal justice system in Canada for having let all of these boys go. And there were some internet activists who saw those posts and saw the news stories and decided that they wanted to pressure the Canadian government to reopen the investigation.
Now, you met one of the cyber activists who was involved in working to bring her, the people who had raped her, to justice. And his name was Ash. I wonder if you could tell us about him.
Yeah, he's a guy in his mid-20s. He lives in London. He works as an engineer, and he's someone who gets much more sense of fulfillment and satisfaction from his online activism than he was getting from his kind of day paid job. And so he saw these stories about Rutaya Parsons, and he had already, before that had happened, founded this small group called Op Anti-Bully. And the people in Op Anti-Bully had never met each other in person. They were from all over the globe. But they shared the sense of commitment to doing justice as they saw that, right? I mean, they're not part of any formal organization. No one had hired them, but they had put themselves out there in this role. And so they organized and started looking for the identities of the teenage boys whom Rutaya had accused of assaulting her. And the idea was to generate pressure on the police and prosecutors in Canada to take action.
What kind of methods do internet activists like Ash use to try to bring what they think of as justice to a case?
Well, you know, once in a while, people who do this work, sometimes they will do something really aggressive, like hack into someone's private social media account. That's clearly breaking the law. But oftentimes they don't have to do anything like that because people think that their identities are hidden because, for example, they're using, a made-up handle on Twitter. But in fact, their Twitter account is linked to other accounts they have online that do use their real names. And so if you start kind of following the trail of digital breadcrumbs, it's not very hard to connect people up to their real identities. So often it's just a matter of putting the pieces together, honestly.
What motivates these people? It seems as though from your piece that they do get kind of a high off doing it, but also, you know, maybe there's a white knight thing going on.
Yeah, absolutely. They call this white knight work, and I think they're a sort of a combination of motivations. I got a really strong sense that they cared very much about the communities they'd formed. They really felt like the people they were working with were people whom they could trust and whom they cared about deeply. Now, the group I wrote about, Op Anti-Bully, actually fell apart and had a lot of infighting during the time I was reporting. But the motivation was this one for community. And then I think also, you're right, they see themselves as riding to the rescue. They are vigilantes, but, you know, if you are sure that you are right, and these people have a real sense of righteousness about their work, then the fact that you're kind of making up the rules on your own might not bother you. And, you know, anonymous generally tends to be anti-authority and very skeptical of mainstream law enforcement. So the people who I was watching and reporting on, you know, kind of laughed off the notion that the cops were objecting to the way that they had intervened in the case.
How do law enforcement authorities and police in the United States, how do they feel about people like this getting involved in cases?
I think generally people like this makes the cops nervous because no one can control them. The police don't know who they are. They just, you know, it's not like they're coming down to the station and saying, hey, I found this evidence and here I am. It's all happening through these kind of shadowy videos and press releases online. And the police also worry about people taking the law into their own hands and making threats, which is definitely something that internet activists like these do. So there's a real tension with law enforcement.
They also seem to be fallible, like everybody is. They don't always get it right.
Oh, that's true. You know, in the Rehtaeh Parsons case, the people I was following were very careful and did not, in the end, name anyone. But another group of people in Anonymous who were similarly trying to figure out these boys' identities released the name of a boy and blamed him for this crime. And it wasn't him. They had the wrong person. So, you know, you do have that problem. Now, the activists I was talking to when I would ask them about this would say, hey, you know, the police make mistakes too, which of course is true. But, you know, I think that whenever you have vigilante justice, you have the danger of people doing harm in the name of doing good.
And in our last 30 seconds here before we go to news, I mean, do you think, though, that they are performing a service, that they're coming in and filling a hole that the police aren't able to cover?
Well, I do think there's a real vacuum because there's so much going on online, you know, cyberbullying, stalking, harassment. The police have a really hard time dealing with all of it. And it's worth pointing out that in the Rehtaeh Parsons case, in fact, the Canadian prosecutors did reopen that case and they did bring criminal charges against two boys. And I'm pretty sure that just wouldn't have happened without these internet activists. So, you know, it sort of depends on how you feel about that outcome.
Well, we're talking right now with Emily Bazelon, author of Sticks and Stones, Defeating the Culture of Bullying and Rediscovering the Power of Character and Empathy. And we're wondering what you think about this.
You can call in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this idea of online activists taking on bullies, people who post harassing pictures, maybe who have committed crimes? Is it a good thing? Or are we trying people in the court of public opinion? Do you think these online activists are bullies themselves or tools in fighting bullying and sexual assault? Have you been a victim of cyberbullying like what we're talking about here? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org.
We're talking with Emily Bazelon, author of Sticks and Stones, Defeating the Culture of Bullying and Rediscovering the Power of Character and Empathy. We're talking about the rise of online activist groups who take on bullies and sometimes pressure police.
And we want to hear from you. Have you encountered, or maybe your kids have encountered, harassment, bullying online? Do you feel sometimes like it's the Wild West where people can do and say whatever they want and there's really nothing anybody can do to police it? And if you think so, do you think it's good or bad that there are vigilantes online, in effect, who will try to police that? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email, talk@WPR.org.
Emily, right now, groups like Anonymous and their offshoot groups like this Operation Anti-Bully, they're amorphous. The members come and go. There are no rules that govern them. When there is dissension in the ranks, it just can lead to a falling out because there's no mechanism for dealing with that. Do you think that as we go along, they will become more organized and maybe codify things so that they can be useful and also be organized?
You know, I don't actually think these groups are going to become more organized. I think that the whole point of them is that they kind of rise and fall. They spring up when they see the need for it. And the people who are doing them don't want them to become kind of institutional. They like the idea that it's all very nimble and of the moment.
One of the stories that you talk about was the assault of a 16-year-old that took place in Steubenville, Ohio. That one was pretty recent. How did online activists address that situation?
So that was a case in which it pretty quickly after pictures and accounts of a sexual assault circulated, there were arrests made. But there was also a lot of local discussion about whether there were other cover-ups going on of other crimes by student athletes. And an activist who was going by the handle KY Anonymous put out a call for evidence. Somebody sent him a video that was pretty damning of a group of boys laughing about this rape that had happened. And he put it up online. And the video helped turn Steubenville into a kind of national rallying cry about the problems of rape culture.
And what happened to the activist who started the ball rolling?
Well, he stayed involved in the case, and then he was raided by the FBI. And other activists thought that he had been involved potentially in hacking a site of the football team. He denied that. But there was this law enforcement involvement, and then he also started drawing a lot of attention to himself online, which is something that in Anonymous you're really not supposed to do. They really don't like the idea of people glory-seeking as for being part of the group. So he's become a pretty controversial figure within the group as well as outside it.
I'm curious about how the parents of some of these victims, how they perceive these activists. Does it seem welcome, like the cavalry is coming, or does it seem like an unknown force that's a little scary?
You know, I think that at first, parents are often nervous. You know, they usually don't know what Anonymous is, and it's just confusing. But as they see Anonymous having some results, then parents may warm up to them. So in the Rehtaeh Parsons case, Rehtaeh's mother was very nervous at first, but then she realized that the activism was, in fact, putting pressure on the Canadian government, and so she started to really welcome their involvement.
Having spent so much time with these groups, gotten to know the ins and outs and the infighting and sort of what made them tick, and having studied a lot of these cases and their outcomes, do you have personal feelings about this, about whether these groups are doing good?
You know, I feel very torn. It's partly because, you know, whenever you spend a lot of time reporting people, you tend to see their good sides as well as their flaws. And I felt like I could really understand their sense of injustice about some of these cases. On the other hand, if you take a step back, it is anxiety-provoking to think that people are taking the law into their own hands. There's just a lot of harm that can come from that. And I think that in some ways these people have a lot of power because they're dealing with technology in a way that a lot of times the police either don't have time to do or really don't have the skill and expertise to do. So I was left feeling very mixed about it and incredibly curious about how this new form of activism will continue to develop, because I really think that we're just at the beginning and we're going to see this more and more.
Now, you said there was a lot of harm that can come. What is an example of the most egregious example of harm that you've seen doing covering this?
I think the worst thing is people getting accused of crimes who are innocent and really being, you know, stigmatized online, having your name and picture and your identity exposed as being a rapist when in fact you didn't do anything wrong, that's a pretty upsetting, horrifying thing to have happen. And once a mistake like that's been made, it's very hard to put the genie back in the bottle, given how Google search results work and how much rumors can kind of spread like wildfire online. So that's the problem that I see. It's the collateral damage.
I want to go to the phones right now. Let's take a call from Sherry, joining us from Green Bay. Hi, Sherry.
Hello.
Hi. What has been your experience with this?
Well, mine's not on a scale that serious. I'm just talking about cyberbullying to the effect of, like, when I go on Facebook, I'll play just a game. And, you know, when you're on the game, and, for example, it's The Price is Right, people will put in, hi, good luck, things like that. A few times that I have been on there, and I'm an adult, so I don't really feed into it, but there'll be people, there's a picture of me and my daughter on there, and they'll say, oh, look at that lesbian, she's an ugly fat hoe. And I think, golly, I didn't even do anything, but they have to hide behind the computer and be mean. And I know it's probably a young child, but I'll comment back most of the time I don't comment back, but sometimes I will. And when I did, then another girl jumped in, another Facebook profile jumped in. I'm assuming it was a girl, with her to jump on me, just keep calling me names and how ugly I was. And I just am thinking, wow.
Sherry, would you feel better if someone were there, I don't know, policing it or keeping people like that at bay?
Yes, I would. And Facebook, you know, you can sit there and report abuse, but no one ever gets back to you. No one ever follows up with you. So you don't really know if reporting it, really, if they're doing anything about it or kicking them off of Facebook. You never get the follow-up from it. So by clicking that button to say, I'm reporting it, are you reporting that person? Are they doing anything about it? I would love to have some follow-up and some feedback to find out if they are actually doing something about it.
All right. Well, thank you so much for sharing your experience with us. Appreciate you calling in. And Emily, I mean, do you think that Sherry is like other people you've come across, people who might feel powerless when they're online?
Well, I do think there's an incredible amount of mean anonymous trolling going on online, which Sherry was just talking about, where you just feel like you're doing your thing or minding your own business, and all of a sudden people are trashing you for no reason. And that's one issue with anonymity. It gives people license for a lot of speech that I think if they had to attach their names to it, they wouldn't do.
How do you see the kind of online activism we've been talking about today? How do you see it evolving? It sounds like there are some people who are carrying that work forward, even as the groups kind of come and go. In general, it seems as though they will keep coming back to it and keep doing what they feel is right for justice online. What do you see happening?
Well, I think it's very fluid, but, you know, Anonymous, this group that we're talking about, that's sort of the umbrella, started off, first they were kind of a bunch of pranksters. Then they started having more of a political consciousness, but mostly working on issues surrounding free speech and the free internet. And now I think they're branching out into this white knight work involving sexual assault and injustice, as they see it, from law enforcement failing to do their job. And I also think that increasingly this will be not so much about hacking. That'll be a little of it, but it'll really be about figuring out how to do traditional political organizing online. So how to use Twitter to get people together in a way that then could lead to an action like a rally or some other way of putting, you know, pressure on a prosecutor or the police to change what they're doing.
Do you think it will come to the point where you're the parent of a victim, something bad happens, and you go, you know what, I'm going to go to Anonymous, and it's that simple, everybody knows about it?
I mean, I think people are already trying to do that, and there's a little bit of just sort of random serendipity involved in which of these stories really catch the imagination of the activists. But there's another recent case in Merrillville, Missouri, where what began as a very well-reported investigative piece of journalism about a sexual assault and charges had been dropped, turned into an opportunity for internet activism. And in fact, the case was reopened, like the Rehtaeh Parsons case. And then at one point, the mother of the girl who had made the allegations got upset about how the new investigation was progressing, and she called on Anonymous for more help. It was a really interesting moment where you could just see the dynamic unfolding.
Well, it's something to keep an eye on. Emily, thank you so much for joining us and talking about it today.
My pleasure. Thanks for your great questions.
We've been talking to Emily Bazelon, author of Sticks and Stones, Defeating the Culture of Bullying and Rediscovering the Power of Character and Empathy.
We've been talking about Anonymous and other groups that do anti-bullying and other kinds of activism on the internet.